Hello and welcome back to Project Pod with me, Marietta Sandilands. Today in pod number 15, I'm very happy to have Kiko Matthews back on the podcast. Kiko is an adventurer and a campaigner. And since we last met in May 2017, when we recorded our first podcast, a lot has happened. Kiko has had brain surgery for a very rare life-threatening tumour called Cushing's. She, a few months later after the surgery, rode the Atlantic and broke the record for the fastest solo crossing by a woman. She's also just come back from completing the Wadi Rum Ultra Marathon in Jordan, which was 5 days, running a total of just over 156 miles, which is 250 kilometres, running across the desert in Jordan in 50 degree heat. Just like her rowing challenge, Kiko was not a runner before she took up the challenge to run the Wadi Rum. And she had, I think, a total, she says, of 14 training sessions. Kiko is now on track with putting together her next challenge, Kick Plastic, K-I-K Plastic. So this next challenge is all about helping people to reduce their plastic use and consumption. And next year in 2019, she's going to be cycling around the UK and getting primary schools involved in beach cleans. So you can follow what she's doing. All of that is on her website, kikomatthews.co.uk, and on her Instagram of the same name. So I love talking with Kiko today, and her down-to-earth approach to challenges and life really comes through. Something I particularly loved is her describing how important it is to have a sense of purpose, and really how, in order to find this, she thinks it's nothing more complicated really than just keeping going, because as she put it, you never know what's around the corner in terms of the people you meet and the skills that you'll develop. So I hope you enjoy our conversation today.
So today I'm here again, once again, very happily with amazing adventurer extraordinaire Kiko Matthews, who is back on the podcast. Thank you so much, Kiko, for coming back on. Probably, I'm just thinking, this is almost a year and a bit after we last spoke, and a lot has happened since we last spoke. You have rode the Atlantic, broken the world record for fastest female solo crossing across the Atlantic. You have run.
Had brain surgery.
You've had brain surgery, yep. And you have run an ultra marathon in Jordan, and you have started a new project, Kick Plastic. It's a lot of things since we last spoke. So let's start back at the beginning at the row, because I think when we last spoke, I was asking you, we were talking about the training and your inspiration for it. Can you remind people a little bit about why you did the row, the crossing the Atlantic solo?
Yes, sure. There's lots of reasons. I don't think there's like one specific. There's like, you know, the selfish reason. I love a challenge and don't want to be sat in a classroom teaching. So I was like, great idea. Mum also thought that Prince Harry would be a great boyfriend. And I agreed and didn't know how to get his attention. So that was that kind of like joke. But also I wanted to show women in particular, but I think the same thing applies to men, that anything can be achieved if we support each other, we work together, and also to raise money for King's College Hospital, who had saved my life in 2009. And halfway through my training, then I was back in hospital having the second pituitary tumor removed. But obviously, when I decided to do the Atlantic, that wasn't part of the plan. So yeah, my original.
Can you quickly remind people about that? You had a pituitary tumour. What exactly is that?
So I had a disease called Cushing's, which is caused by a pituitary tumour. The end kind of result of that tumour is a high level of cortisol, which is your stress hormone, and hormones are very, very, very sensitive. So my whole body was basically put into a life-threatening state. They went up my nose and they took it out. It was 6 millimetres in 2009, and then just by pure chance, 8 years later, in the middle of my training, in the middle of my campaign, it came back. It was only 4 millimeters this time, so wasn't nearly as difficult to kind of recover. And I mean, the operation is exactly the same. It's probably actually a bit more difficult to get it out when it's smaller, but ultimately, it was easier to recover, and I was back training 10 days later, I think, after that little episode.
I think I saw the pictures of you going into King's Hospital in your athleisure wear, cycling in for your operation, and then a couple of days after or something, you were out again. Which is, I mean, what were the people who did the doctors and nurses? Were they slightly surprised to see this? I was certainly surprised to see it.
I don't think they knew. yes, I did cycle to my operation because I was like, well, I was cycling yesterday and I was cycling the day before, so why wouldn't I cycle on the day? It wasn't like I had to be in a special sort of, you know, state. I just had to get to the hospital. So I got to the hospital how I would have normally have done it. Obviously, like, the tumour makes me a little bit manic and full of energy, so it kind of helped that that was the situation. And then 10 days later I did a 100-kilometre bike ride. I mean, they probably wouldn't have said go for a 100-kilometre bike ride, but they definitely say, like, you know, do what you feel capable of. And my mental madness is a bit like, I will not be ill. I am going to continue. And so I did. I mean, it took the whole day. I stopped at the pub and I went to the party and
And that was, they'd said that that was safe and okay to do in terms of the recovery and, you know.
Yeah, the only thing you're not allowed to do is bend down and lift heavy weights because it's all, like, blocked in the top of your nose. So you don't want to be increasing the pressure in your brain so that that, like, plug doesn't pop and your brain fluid doesn't fly out. So as long as you're not doing either of those two things, it's fine.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so you had your training was interrupted by brain surgery number two, and then you went back into training again. When we spoke before, we didn't know that the tumour had returned, and so it was obviously that was just before that you've had the operation. Yeah, what I was wondering is not just actually the effect of having the tumour, but I know that there was a point when you considered whether you would actually do the challenge and whether it was the right thing and how you made up your mind to actually do it. Because anyone would have said at that point, that's absolutely fine. You've had this major surgery. You know, you don't need to do the challenge. Everyone would have understood. But, and I know that there was a point when even you were questioning if you should do it. Was that due to the surgery or was that a sort of general, you know, of having less training time? What was that due to and how did you decide to do it?
So in about end of October, this sort of time, probably last year, I hadn't got the money that I needed to take the boat out and get it back. And I also was feeling a little bit like I wasn't getting any stronger. If anything, I was only getting weaker. And I just thought that maybe if I left it until now, which is what, December 2019, maybe I'd be more successful. And maybe I would have been more successful. But a friend of mine who'd done the Atlantic said, oh no, everyone gets those sort of like pre-row jitters. Just get over it and grow some balls. And I love a bit of fighting talk. So I thought, okay, so I just go over it. And as much as we don't like the phrase grow some balls, I did sort of, you know, think about it all. And I did just get back on the bandwagon and carry on. And it was fine.
Yeah. So it was almost someone challenging you and going, actually, you can do this. Someone giving you,
yeah,
go and do it.
Yeah, yeah. And a couple of people had kind of, you know, sided with me and thought it was a good idea. So I was like on it. And then this one guy was just not having any of it. And he said, don't be so ridiculous. You're going to do it. So I said, oh, so I was like, okay. Yeah. You're the only person that's actually said that to me. Everyone else was like, yeah, yeah, I think it's a good idea. Why not? Yes, great, great.
Yeah. Which is really interesting, isn't it? Someone who kind of feeding into that strong, but kind of the part of you that's in doubt, but the strong part within you and helping you actually get back on track and do it. So the Atlantic, the row, 49 yes. days. Congratulations again for breaking that record. Fastest female. You're 49 days at sea by yourself. I think some people I know have asked you, assumed that there was like a little boat going alongside you, perhaps. That wasn't the case, was it?
No boats, nothing, just me, myself and I.
No mobile phones, no
Yes, mobile phone, but not for phoning mobiles because there's no mobile connection in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Like you need
a satellite phone.
Yeah, just for the bare essentials at $1.50 a minute. It's not like for your everyday chat. So, yeah, that was it.
And I followed your blog when you were writing about the experience, which was fascinating to kind of hear of the different things that you were experiencing. What were some of the most memorable points of being in the Atlantic?
The big waves, the flat, calm nothings, which are almost worse in a different kind of way to the big waves. I used to love standing on my boat and like looking out and seeing if I could see anything. And then it's just like you're so remote. There's just nothing around you for miles and miles and miles for days and days and days, which is madness. I really just enjoyed kind of the calm and being the calm, not always calm, but the mental calm, not the physical calm. And it was very boring and very relentless. And the smallest little thing would make the difference to like a really happy shift or a not so great shift. So yeah, it really like kind of heightens your stuff, your perception of things maybe.
How many hours were you rowing for each day roughly?
Yeah, I was very flexible. I kind of went with the weather. So when I left, it was really windy and it was really hectic. But your boat goes really fast, but there's no way I'm going out of that cabin at nighttime when I can't see. So I would hide in my cabin at nighttime when it was really windy. But then when it was really calm, I would row pretty much throughout the night, maybe with a little bit more sleep during the evening, nighttime. I started off doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And then it got painful and I did 1 hour on, 1 hour off. And then I did like 1 hour on and 20 minutes off so I could have longer sleep at night. I kept on like mixing it up depending on how the day was. And bearing in mind I could sleep whenever, I would just like make sure I did 12 hours in a day or in the 24-hour period. And just kind of try and keep track of what I'd done. Very relaxing, very, very flexible.
I had a question from Gareth Sewell, who was wondering, how did you cope with the loneliness, or was that something you felt out there?
No loneliness, because loneliness is 100% not about being alone. You can be the loneliest person ever and have, you know, the world and his wife. You know, you can be lonely at a party and a lifestyle that is all about partying, and the loneliness is a much deeper thing. So, I do not believe that anyone is going to be leaving me on my own. I believe I can still survive in my boat. I still believe that I have my community who are supporting me. People were there, even though they weren't there in like figure, in actual solid form. They were there in like my mind, and I knew that they were there supporting me. So yeah, loneliness and being alone and solitude are very different things.
Yeah.
So yes, no loneliness, just alone, solitude. Yeah, I loved it, actually.
I think something I've asked you about before was about fear, in terms of fear of the massive waves, or if anything happened to you. I know that you had, there was an alarm that you could press, but that only had enough juice in it for 48 hours. Is that right?
Yeah, the EPIRB.
Yeah. So these things to me that seem absolutely terrifying, but how did you mentally kind of conquer any of the, or was it even a question of conquering the fear associated with these things, or is that just not really that you were feeling?
I think you have to ask yourself like what you're fearful of, and I mean the bottom line is that people are fear death, and I don't really fear death, so that's not an issue, because I mean we're all dying. I don't know why any of us worry about it. And I think the more you're living your life, the less you probably fear the death. I don't know, maybe that's just the way I interpret it. But I don't fear the death. And what is the point of worrying about it? Because you can't do anything about it. Like you put everything in place. A, you stuck yourself in that position in the first place. So you got yourself to blame. But secondly, it's like you're strapped in if you're stupid enough to leave your cabin door open and you capsize and your boat sinks, well then survival of the fittest. No, I'm joking, but you know, you've got to put your, you've got to be sensible about it, because you probably don't want to die. You probably don't want to die, and therefore you'll make sure that your cabin door is shut, and you make sure that you're attached, and you make sure this and that. And yes, if all the things go wrong and you've got a button to press, you press the button, they locate you. Yes, your EPIRB only works for 48 hours, but once you've made contact with Falmouth Coast Guard and a ship that's coming to rescue you, you should be all right, unless everything goes down and then you've got another EPIRB. I don't know whether you can stop and start.
What is an EPIRB?
It's the thing that sends out the message that you need rescuing.
Okay.
It's like the emergency something or other something. Okay. The sailors out there will know what it is, but it doesn't really matter. I don't really care. All these acronyms, it just saves my life. That's all I know.
Yeah. And I remember seeing the pictures as well of your hands that were in quite a state after, after, you know, a couple of weeks at sea. How was it physically on your body in terms of being sitting in one position, using your hands, all of this repetitive stuff with the seawater as well?
How
did you deal with the physical kind of pain or discomfort?
I guess I trained, so I knew that was, you know, my hands were already a bit hard. And to be fair, those pictures you saw of my hands were after I'd done my washing up or my clothes washing. And anytime you get into a shower or a bath with like hard skin, it always goes like big and makes it look way more impressive. It's the wonders of social media. My bum was quite sore, had like little spots, and my wrists got a bit painful because I would feather my oars when it was rough. I had a knot in my back, which is a bit painful. Occasionally I'd get a pain in my knee if I put like too much height on my seat, so I then would change my legs. And you just kind of like, you have to adapt to it. You have to either put up with it and get over it, or adapt to it, or move and change things. Or, you know, if your hands were really sore all of a sudden, then you just use the tips of your fingers, or if your wrist was hurt, I don't know, you just kind of, you have to get over it, don't you? Because you've got to get to the other end. So there's no really like, it's the easiest thing to have to deal with and just get over, because you've got no choice. It's like, I can't get off and get on a bus or go to the pub or whatever. It's like, you are there in the middle of the Atlantic. You either do it or you quit. And quitting was never really an option because I'd spent so long planning it. And I didn't actually ever feel like quitting.
Did you not?
No. No, I had one night when I spent a little longer sleeping than maybe other nights. And I had a few moments when I was like, oh God, this is just like so painful and dull. I should be like, whatever. And then you just like go back to why you're doing it. And you think, why am I doing this? Oh yeah, that's why. Because like years ago or months ago, I couldn't walk and I couldn't get up and there are other people in far worse situations to this one I'm doing it for, and I want to show people I can do it. And I obviously, if I quit, then I can't do it and I can't prove to people. So yeah, that's the whole reason why you have purpose to doing things.
Yeah. And do you feel that it was after you'd had the pituitary tumor do you feel that you, I know often you hear people talking, you've had these very these, you know, extreme experiences that then make them value and appreciate the life that they have. Was that your experience in kind of driving you to do this, of knowing just how precious life was?
It was. I don't think it was that. That's more selfish. I was obviously set out to do it, and I was enjoying it. I was thinking about what I wanted to do in the future, and if I didn't have the record, if I didn't row the Atlantic, then I'd have to think again. So it was kind of like, in the selfish wise, it was in the game plan for the next thing. But at the end of the day, I honestly and truly was like, I'm raising money for Kings and they've saved my life. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here. I mean, someone else might have saved my life and I probably would have raised money for them, but ultimately it was them. And I've got all these women and girls who paid to be part of my project and are paid because they believe in me and they do believe, like, and all that sort of stuff. And like, yeah, I've got to do it because that's why I'm here and that's why I'm doing it. So the three elements of the me, the everybody else, and the charity element really kind of just made it happen. I mean, when it happened, I left my job because I was just like, yeah, whatever, I hate my job, shouldn't even be here. Well, why would I carry on doing a job I didn't like doing when I'm being given a second chance to like reset? It's a shame that people don't have that thought without the illness. It's like everybody needs to have a little bout of realization before they get it.
And in terms of other things, are there any sort of realizations or things that you really learned from your crossing?
Yeah, I think my big one, which I'm now like, I think it's going through to my what's next, and what I try to, I guess it's my sort of message, if we're going to get deep about it, is that it's like I had nothing when I was out there apart from my boat, my water, my food, me, myself, and I. Had my iPhone with some really rubbish music on it, waves, sea, the odd animal, you know, the clothes on me and stuff, and little things like even a seagull coming and flying, or the bird that came and visited me every day, or the fact that I found some extra sweeties, or the wind would get a bit faster. They would like literally change my day, and my happiness would be incredible. And I was like, it's so mad. When we're at home on our daily basis, we like go shopping to make ourselves happy, we go and meet people and we do stuff, and we go to the pub and we go to the theme parks and we go to the cinema and we do all of this stuff to make ourselves happy. And actually, because if you could just get rid of everything, you'd get happy, you'd be happy with like the smallest thing ever. You know, if you ate toast every day, all you'd need to have would be to have a bit of cheese, and suddenly you've got the most amazing meal ever. But as it is, we're allowed to have whatever we want, wherever we want, from wherever, whenever, blah, 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 easy at the dial of a phone, and we just don't appreciate it because we have everything, and then we will not be content if we don't have everything, and that becomes not only dangerous for ourselves but also for the planet.
Mm-hmm. I know you're now doing, you've been doing talks, and you've actually written a book, haven't you, as well? So I wanted to ask you as well, how did it feel when you came into Barbados and when you could actually see that you were, I was watching your, tracking your little boat online, and you see when you arrived, how did that feel after 49 days and you knew you had the record?
It's funny because I was like, oh, thank God I haven't got to row again in 2 hours' time. And it was really nice to see people and like, that was it, done. But I'd actually started to sort of relatively enjoy myself more, and I was like in a rhythm, and I guess it's that kind of feeling of like what people, you know, like what meditators and yogi people and that sort of like are looking to find. And I guess I found that. So when I came in, it was like, yeah, that's great. But I don't think I still have appreciated what I've potentially achieved, no, what I have achieved. But I say potentially because I still don't really see it as anything huge. But I think if there'd been like more of me in the team, we would have wound each other up as to like how amazing it was. But because it was only me, and I'm very like bleh about all of my achievements and things that I do, I'm just like, yeah, whatever. I don't think I'd really kind of like got sort of all excited about it in my head, and I was just like, and it was such a stressful day, the day coming in, because all my electrics went down and I was worried that I wasn't going to get in on time, and I got the TV crew waiting for me and my mum and dad waiting for me, blah, blah, blah. I was just like so just focused on making sure I got in safely on time before the sunset that I hadn't really, I don't think, really kind of sat down and appreciated. Probably if I'd had a few pints of cider, it would have been a very different story, but no, I didn't have any cider, so it didn't happen.
It must have been emotional coming in, seeing your family there, and just, I remember, I think I saw pictures of you having a mojito as well after.
That was the most emotional thing. Well, no, because the thing is, I'd seen them flashing the mirror at me, like right at the tip of Barbados. Then I saw the pilot boat, which was taking me past around the, that got my TV crew mates on it. filming crew, and then they took me around to the finish line, which was not seeing my wasn't at the same point. So that was a little bit like, and a few boats came out to see me. I don't know how they knew or who they were, but they came out and said like hi and well done and stuff. So that was like me like actually finishing. And then I went round in the dark, and it was just all that whole process was all so slow that by the time I actually got to land and I saw people, it kind of it felt like it was about 4 hours. So I'd already in my head kind of finished and was done and ready, and now all I was doing was just like humouring the journey by rowing another 4 hours around the headlands to see everyone. And then yeah, it was I guess it's quite weird. I want to do it again.
Really?
Yes, because then I might appreciate it a bit more. I'd be like, woohoo! But I know, I just did step off and everyone was like, are you all right? And I was like, yeah, fine. How's everyone? Are you proud of what you've achieved? And I was like, well, yeah, I suppose so. Like, 8 months ago, I was in hospital. Now I just rode across the Atlantic on my own.
Exactly. And so after Barbados, you went back to England, and how did you, I was thinking, how do you kind of cope with after you've done something so, you know, incredible, however you want to, it is, you know, an incredible achievement.
How yeah.
do you then decide what to do next and re-find your purpose again? I heard a question
yeah.
actually from Will saying, how do you deal with the kind of need to just constantly do something bigger and better?
Well, I don't think I'm doing necessarily anything bigger. I'm doing probably something better, different, very different. I don't know, I came home, it was pissing it down with rain. It was Easter weekend. I was looking out my little cabin thinking, oh my God, what am I doing here? You've got like so much, like it's so great, that feeling of completion and all that. And then you've got to like start all over again. And like, what do you do? And how on earth do you top? Never rowing before, never been to sea, brain surgery 6 months before you leave, then getting the world record. How do you top that? It's like, it's virtually impossible. I don't know what you could do. Maybe chop a leg off or something. That would not be ideal. But and I just sort of bit by bit had an idea to be the fastest woman to cycle around the world. And I thought, no, I don't want to be, it didn't really fill me with that much excitement. I don't really want to be known in the world of sort of like, this woman who breaks every adventure record that is out there, because like, why am I doing it to be this incredible woman who breaks all the records? That's not what I'm about. And then I just ended up coming to the point of Kick Plastic, which is to cycle around the coast of the UK, 7,000, I think it's about 7,000 kilometers, give or take 200. And every evening doing, or day, some point in the day, doing a beach clean where we stop, or connecting with schools and doing talks, or with local communities and like what they do and how the issues that might be a fisherman or something like that. And for me, that's the environment is really, I'm passionate about it. I'm also passionate about communities and love connecting with people and hearing stories and chatting away. And I love challenges and I love the kind of the more intellectual academic side of setting it all up and getting the sponsorship and trying to get people to believe in what I'm doing. That's all like, feels really amazing when that happens. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. There's meant to be a future to it as well, but we'll have to see like who's in and who supports it and, you know, what we can make of that. But yeah, Kick Plastic.
So that's your new project, which is happening. When will you be setting off on your cycle?
May, June, July. I think from London, unless I have a sponsor who says something else, from London out to the East Coast, along and around, all through Wales, all through Scotland, back down again. The idea that I leave on my own and hopefully like Forrest Gump style a little bit, that people join as we go and, you know, the message is spread and like the outdoor life and the plastic issue and how do we change this? And really, like for me, the plastic is a metaphor for how we live these days. Like it's this consumer greedy lazy kind of I want it now kind of like, I want it now kind of lifestyle that is what it represents. And so hopefully with my beach talks and all that sort of stuff. And if I get any media out there, that I might be able to get this message across. And I think I've got evidence of it, because I've crossed the Atlantic with nothing and I could see the changes in my happiness. I was, you know, as happy, if not more, when I found the sweeties on my boat as when I am that I get a message, you know, an email from the CEO of Sky or his PA or whatever. Like, it's the same level of happiness. It's like, so why do I not, like, tell more people about it? Really, give it a go. And so, yeah, that's the plan. You only asked me where I was going from when you got that answer. Sorry.
No, that's a great answer. But when you say you want people to give it a go, what do you mean that you want them to give it a go? What's
I want them to, like, to just to think. I mean, I think the easiest way to say to give it a go is, my question would be, every time you're about to hand money over, I guess the question is, do I need it or I want it? And sometimes your body, your brain will just go, yeah, I actually just want it, but I'm going to still want it. But sometimes it just makes you question, do I actually really want this or need it? You know, it's that kind of extra top that you're buying, or that extra pair of jeans, and why are you actually buying that? And that food that you're about to buy, are you buying it because, you know, are you actually hungry, or can you just wait till you get home? Or actually, maybe you keep asking yourself that question when you buy sandwiches from a shop, and do you want these sandwiches? Do you need them? Well, if I'd made them at home, then no, I wouldn't need them. I'd just be wanting them. And it's kind of, I think it's just an awareness of our behavior and ourselves and other people and the environment. So that's what I'd like people to give a go at doing. It's just like reducing their consumerism and trying to be outdoors a bit more. I was very West Country outdoors a bit more, and try doing beach cleans a bit more often, and try just being a bit more simple life, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm interested, what, because I know you do lots of talks now,
what do you find yourself saying over again at them? What are the messages aside from that?
What are the questions that people often want to ask you and want to know about and want from you?
I mean, there are very sort of basic standard questions, like, you know, where did you go to the loo, and what was the scariest bit, and what was the best bit, and da-da. But the thing, the messages that I try to portray from my journey is, like, how strong purpose is, when it's not about us, when it's not about you, when it's not about me. You know, the world record was a purpose that was about me, and actually there were times I didn't really care about the world record, but when I started thinking about the purpose that was not me, I had more driving force to continue. The worrying element, I just think worrying is such a waste of time, because what does it do? There's like, it might not even happen. If it does happen, like, why be stressed about it before it's even happened? Why not be like at your best to ready to perform for that thing that has worried you? It's not like you still worry about some things, but you can reduce that by analyzing it and being just really black and white about what you're worrying about. And what I was saying, like, about the little bits and pieces that you don't need in life. I think that's one of my three messages.
The idea of finding purpose, how would you recommend that someone, because that's obviously a process that you've been on yourself, but how would you recommend people go about discovering that for themselves, finding, connecting to something that's bigger than themselves?
So I've been doing a lot of, like, I've volunteered since I was young, I guess. I went on adventures when I was like 14, 15, 16. My parents are very charitable. When I was in one summer holidays at school, I worked with autistic kids on some sort of group. And then I've always been quite into, like, helping others and doing things for other people. It might not be like my direct mate, but it might be someone who I've got no idea who they are. And I just kind of feel, I think the more times that you realize where you've been and that people have helped you to get out, and then you go, ah, actually, someone's helped me on that situation or whatever, and therefore I know how difficult it is. When I put myself in difficult situations, the more I realize that people have helped me, and therefore you have the same role to do with other people, whether that be charity, financial giving, whether that be volunteering at Crisis at Christmas, whether that be, you know, doing your talk for free, whether that's, you know, phoning up your mate, or your mate phoning you up at 3 o'clock in the morning because they're about to commit suicide and they can talk to you. It's like, you know, whatever it is, you kind of, I think, you eventually find what you want to do. And it's just, yeah, it's really sad when people don't have, like, the purpose could literally be, you know, it could be a 24-hour purpose, it could be a lifelong purpose, it could be a kind of a project purpose. But I think it makes life a lot more worth living than if you're just about you. Like, what's the point in you being here on this earth if it's just about you? A bit pointless. But yes, if you're there for, and I, you know, your kids and stuff, that is like a certain amount of purpose, but I still think your kids are still you. So people say, oh yeah, the purpose is that I bring up my kids, and it's like, yes, but your kids need to see that you're doing other stuff as well, so that it's not just about them. Because I think as soon as you start thinking that life is about them and their purpose, it all revolves around them, they become very much egocentric as well. So I think it's really important that kids see you as a parent doing things that are not just about you as a child. So yeah, I don't think kids can be a purpose. I think unless your kid maybe is disabled, then maybe it's slightly different, because that obviously requires a lot more. But I think for a sort of your average child, definitely needs to have a sort of a role model where the purpose is not them, where they are not. I was not the centre of my parents' world, definitely not. But A, there were four of us, but they had other stuff going on. They made sure that everything was in place to look after us and that we were happy and that we were fed and that we get clothes on our, and we were educated and all that stuff. But we weren't, you know, my parents weren't living to have us. They had us and they loved us, but it was very much like they continued their life and they did the things that they did and we were part of it. And, you know, dad was a doctor, so that was his purpose in life. And mum was a house mum and a mum and a charity, like she did some charity, she did some teaching and she did bits and pieces and that. So there was like lots. So I think that's really important too.
Yeah.
Just for those parents out there who think their children is their purpose for being on this earth.
And that's interesting why you've then chosen to include children in this next challenge, in the Kick Plastic Challenge, by going to primary schools or getting the primary schools involved in the beach cleans. Was that always something that you felt was going to be key to it?
I just think that comes from my teaching background, you know, doing science at secondary school and just realizing you cannot teach a kid about the important things in life in a clinical classroom. Like, yeah, I can teach about the area of a triangle, I can teach you about the equation of photosynthesis, but I can't do the real stuff out in the real world. And you're not going to see me. I am one kind of adult that I would hope that kids would sort of look up to. You're not going to see me like I want to be seen in a classroom because I'm a teacher and I'm authority, whereas actually you get me on a beach and do what I'm doing, I'm suddenly this like very different cool woman who's like across the Atlantic and is doing this stuff, and you become a very different person, which they look up to differently to if you're in a classroom. But yeah, I also think that the outdoors and the education, oh my god, we could have a whole other podcast about it. But yes, and I think kids deserve to have those experiences which their parents may or may not give them.
Yeah. Okay, and I also, in between Kick Plastic and the Atlantic, you've also recently come back from running an ultramarathon in Jordan, which, slightly similarly to the Atlantic Row, you hadn't really been running before doing the ultramarathon.
Didn't really know what I was doing, no. Well, my mate was like, do it, and I said, well, I hate running, and don't run, you'll be fine, you've rode the Atlantic, you can do anything. I was like, oh god, that is literally like my motto for life, so I have to do it. So I had to do a tiny bit of running training just to make sure that my feet moved quicker than a walk, and then I did some walking training.
Did you actually do over how many months, and how many miles or kilometers so is this ultramarathon?
So the ultramarathon is 250 kilometers over 5 days, so that's six marathons in 5 days, in the desert. In the sunshine it's about 45 degrees. I did a marathon in 2013 in 6 hours 57, so I made the cutoff by 3 minutes. In total, the first run I did was 1 mile. I went up to 9 miles over the space of 8 runs, I think. Or maybe I did 9 miles over 9 runs. That was that for running. Then I went on holiday, this sort of thing around Denmark on a sailing ship where there's not much walking or like leg muscle movement. And then when I got back, I was like, oh, this is a bit of a problem. So I did 12 miles, 18 miles, 24, 23, and then two kind of like 9 and 10 miles over a weekend. And that was it. So I think I did specific training, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 training sessions. No gym, no swimming, very little else.
So you had 14 training sessions, did you say?
Total in 4 months, yes. And then I ran. I moved one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
For 5 days in a row for 250 kilometers.
Which...
And I came last!
Well, congratulations again. But
I completed it. I completed it.
You completed it, exactly.
Some people didn't complete it.
Exactly. And it's the fact that what I'm so fascinated by is this, the mental ability that pushes you through these challenges. And was there a point in the ultramarathon when you thought, this is just a little bit hard? I think, you know, I could just have a little
bit harder
down.
A bit harder than I thought. So after day one, it was so painful. By the end, I had actually had like a mini panic attack halfway through, which is weird because I've never had a panic attack. And I didn't feel like I needed to have a panic attack, but my chest suddenly like tightened up and went weird. So I was like, oh, on the end of the first day, I was like, maybe I'll just do 5 marathons in 5 days rather than 6, because the idea of doing 70 kilometers when I just struggled to do 45 and it was only day one was like insane. And then at the end of day two, which was 53 kilometers, I was definitely on for the fact that I was only going to do 30 kilometers on the 70 kilometer day, which was day three. So I left in the morning, I was only going to do 30 kilometers, and we had cutoff times of 2 hours. So I made it to the 10, I made it to the 2, and then I made it to the 3 because I had to do my 5 marathons. But then I didn't feel too bad. I was like, I can't justify quitting now because I actually have still got a smile on my face and I'm still like, woohoo! So I carried on to 40. And then I still didn't really feel bad enough. Like, it wasn't like I was crawling on the floor to the finish line. So I was like, oh, okay, better go to 50. And once I got to 50, I was like, I'm still okay. And plus, I'm at 50. I can't quit now. And then I thought about Lauren, who had asked me to be, you know, she'd put her faith in me to be part of her team. And I was like, oh, I can't be the only one in the team to not finish. And, you know, she's sorted out sponsorship for me. And she's kind of thinks that, you know, she truly believes that I'm going to do it. And I was like, oh, I'll do it. And I did. I made it to the 70. And then I ran on the day 4, which is amazing. And I came 26 out of 36. I don't know where that came. I got a bit of a jog on. And realised it's a lot easier to run an ultramarathon than it is to walk an ultramarathon. And then day 5 was hell. I was all chirpy for like 20 kilometres. And then it just went downhill from there. And it was miserable. But I finished. And then I was very happy. And I sprinted home.
Well done.
Ta-da! Done.
Yeah. Incredible, really. And, you know, another incredible challenge that you hadn't, you know, where the training was slightly somewhat more limited than the Atlantic training, but it showed...
A lot more limited, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that anyone... No, it doesn't show me. I'm hoping there were quite a few people were like, oh, maybe I'll apply to do a... like an ultramarathon. I hadn't even really considered it. Like, you even get people who do marathons saying, oh, I couldn't do an ultramarathon. It was like, well, I can't even do a marathon, let alone like, you know, what you think is an ultramarathon. So of course you can do it. So yeah, that was that.
Pete, thank you so much for your time and coming on here today. What is there anything that you would like to really leave people with or kind of inspire people towards from all of your challenges and learning to date, really? Anything that we haven't covered yet?
No, I think we've covered everything, isn't it? It's like, I guess, what's the worst that can happen? Give it a go. Every experience is just, even if it goes wrong, is like part of learning and part of becoming more resilient. And around every corner, even if you don't know what's around there, there's like the potential of something incredible and a skill that you might not know that you had, or a person you might not never have met, or, you know, it's just, for me, the excitement of around the corner that I have known, that I don't know about, is just an opportunity to learn and to grow and to be bigger, hopefully not physically bigger, bigger and better. And that, yeah, we all have that opportunity and that ability to change ourselves and to change the environment around us and, you know, help others and all the other great things in life. Thank Drink you. Cider.
Drink cider and eat pork scratching.
Yes.
Where can people find out about your current project and upcoming project, Kit Classic?
Well, people can always follow me, which is the Kiko Matthews on everything, which is always good. And then Kick Plastic again is like Kick Plastic, K-I-K, and then Plastic on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. It's probably more on Instagram at the moment because I'm struggling to run so many social media accounts, so I'm focusing a little bit more on that one.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Kiko. And
thank you.
I know we're all going to be very excited to see what happens next.
Exciting. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, Mother.
Bye.